Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is on a sabbatical. Coming up, have black Americans abandoned international politics in general and solidarity with Haiti in particular? And who is trying to put the U.S. Postal Service out of business? But first, it is the season of occupations, with anti-Wall Street and anti-war protests sweeping the country. Dennis Traynor is one of the organizers of the occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., that kicked off on October 6th.
You know, I'm lucky to the middle class, so they will take time off. And I want to let you know, I'm not going home Sunday. I am here until it is done. We are here. But for those who can't be here, know that I and all of you are standing in their place. We're standing in the place of so many more who cannot be here. For my family member,
Dennis Traynor at Freedom Plaza in Washington. The occupation of Liberty Park near New York's Wall Street has at times attracted tens of thousands of supporters. But the core of organizers is conspicuously white. Kaneni Holder is a spokesperson for a recently formed People of Color working group among the protesters. They're trying to correct the occupation's racial imbalance.
There have been several motions by individuals who organize Occupy Wall Street, as well as on our end from People of Color, to remedy the situation, because it is a glaring problem. On our Tumblr, pococcupywallstreet.tumblr.com, there was a call out to People of Color that was actually written by two white males. There's an open letter from, literally the title is an open letter from two white males who spoke on the issues of realizing that there aren't as many people of color as they would like, yet there is obviously a disparity. So our goals are threefold. One of our goals is to expand the movement, to do outreach and expand, so that, one, we allow other people from communities of color, Harlem, South Bronx, other regions of the Bronx, other regions of Brooklyn, the outer boroughs, Mount Vernon even, and invite them down to see exactly what is happening down on Wall Street. Allow them to see what the General Assembly is, how it operates, when it operates, the culture that is already down there. And then also to give them an opportunity, once they are there, to actually speak up. You know, you can't speak if you don't know and you haven't been able to see, hear, and feel what's already happening on the ground. So one of our goals is to outreach, to have people come down to Wall Street, but then also to expand so that we bring this movement to other areas of the five boroughs, so that there could be occupying Harlem's, occupying South Bronx, occupying Bedford-Stuyvesant, occupying Crown Heights, occupying Fort Greene, so that this movement really does spread. This movement is spreading throughout the country and across the continent, but can also spread amongst the five boroughs. Like, that hasn't really happened as quickly as insurrections in other cities and other places throughout the country, which is kind of ironic. So those are two of our demands.
Is the culture of communications as employed at the occupation a comfortable one for people of color, specifically black folks?
It was almost like a utopia. It was beautiful. You know, all the people are happy and smiling. It seems to be a city onto itself. It's like a metropolis. It's self-run, self-governing. They have their ethics. They have their security forces. They have to ensure that, you know, everybody has a safe place to sleep and feel safe and things like that. There's nurses, there's doctors, there's a library, and there's free food, there's art supplies there for you to make your signs. Like, it's literally a city onto itself. And so I was surprised. I was like, wow, this literally is, as Gandhi said, the change you want to see, be the change you want to see in the world. And so I was like, wow, this is beautiful. Like, you know, everyone's happy and smiley. You know, people go out their way to say excuse me or apologize if they bump into you. And there's these civil conversations about what needs to happen, and I have a lot of that footage. And so I was rather impressed. So that's one side. That's me, Canadian Eye Holder, as I've been walking through for the few days. But I've heard other accounts from people of color to the contrary. Not necessarily black people per se, but there's been Asian people who've said things and at the General Assembly, and they've been shut down. That's also documented on our Tumblr page. People have uploaded their blogs. And that was also referenced in the open letter by the two white men who also acknowledged the fact that these voices were not heard. And not only were the voices not heard, but that's creating a schism, and it's causing emotional harm to people of color, which is never their intention. But because the status quo is so insipid, it's still happening. I also have interviews of two individuals who held signs that said, "Occupy the Hood." And they were there, and they spoke briefly about the fact that they were intimidated by the entire General Assembly structure as it was up until that point. And that was about three days ago that I conducted that interview with them. And so he's been tweeting and Twittering to large numbers of individuals who he said have been following him, but are also a little bit reticent to come down and occupy Wall Street. I've seen this one black individual who came, who's a friend of mine, and her objections were everything from the term occupation, she said, sounded very colonial to begin with, even though I actually disagree with her. I was like, well, they're actually using it in a way that does speak truth to power in terms of they're trying to reoccupy a space and remix reality with a social justice agenda. But that was her qualm. Her qualms were also that they didn't, you know, it's like, where do they use the bathroom? You know, are they aware of the fact that half these people might be spooks, might be police, might be, you know, federal agents of some kind? You know, so that also speaks to the paranoia that people of color, we have a heightened sense of paranoia, a heightened sense of trying to prove that we are not our stigma, that we are not our stereotype. And then also the whole notion of we are going to be the first ones to be brutalized by police, to be locked up. We may have a record of some kind because we've been stopped and frisked or some other reason why we are already in the system. So there's a lot of reasons why people of color have not been as eager to, quote-unquote, occupy Wall Street as some others. So that's why the POC was formed, to invite and inform those who are in some way, shape, or form in a state of shock or a state of fear as to reasons why they are entitled and their voices can and should and will be heard. That is our goal. And also our goal to remedy the situation is to actually do some form of outreach within the Occupy Wall Street movement with our platform and our agenda to talk about how the Wall Street discourse or Occupy Wall Street discourse can also be broadened to include issues from people of color, which include the prison industrial complex, which include racial profiling, which include lack of grocery stores and healthy food options in our neighborhoods.
The park took on a much darker hue when unions endorsed the action and brought their troops down. Do you think that'll be a permanent fixture?
Yes. I think that that particular day was a tipping point whereby a myriad of different reasons people felt like, oh, okay, this is serious. It's been going on for 3 weeks. But I think that October 5th was a day of reckoning where there was a large group of people from different unions, from different hues, from different sexual orientations, all decided to say, you know what, this is real, this is happening, and, you know, let's speak truth to power. And so, yes, the goal is to have a much more broad, all-encompassing, inclusive occupying of Wall Street and occupying of all territories, because, at the end of the day, this actually is the land of the Native American.
Kennedy Holder is an activist writer and performing artist from Harlem. Activist Carl Dix is heading up a campaign to stop Stop and Frisk in New York City and to end mass incarceration as a national policy. He's trying to educate the Wall Street occupiers to the racial realities of the criminal injustice system.
We went down to Wall Street after the first police assault on the demonstrators down there. And, the folks who occupy Wall Street are largely drawn from the middle class. They're largely white. They don't have this day-to-day experience with cops on top of them 24/7. So we felt like we needed to take this issue, particularly in the wake of some of them being beaten down and pepper sprayed by these cops who brutalize and even murder black and Latino people with impunity and get away with it. And what we found was that people wanted to know why the cops did this to them. And when we put it together with how the cops have long been acting in communities of the oppressed, it kind of opened some eyes up. And I'll tell you, the people down at Wall Street, they're displaying a lot of ingenuity and a lot of determination. And I told them, you guys are in the right place, because Wall Street is a symbol of capitalism. And it's capitalism that's responsible for all of these problems that you're identifying here in this country. And to a certain degree, people are looking at things around the world. And so Wall Street is a good symbol for what they're doing and for the horrors in the world. But then I also told them, you got to step up some, because it is a system that you're dealing with, and a system that does brutalize and even murder people around the world and in this country, and has even been brutal to you because you have posed questions that could get at the heart of what their system is based on. Because as we talked about before, when the cops act like an army of occupation in black and Latino communities, this is not just flowing from some backward ideas on the part of a few bad cops. This is coming from actually clamping down on sections of people that this system not only hates, but fears. And they fear them because they know what kind of conditions they're enforcing there, and they're afraid that people might rise up against those conditions, similar to the ways they did in the 1960s, and they remember that in the 1960s, what black people did sparked off a broader revolutionary movement that shook their whole system. So we have been going down to Wall Street, and we're going to continue that. And in fact, we have a meeting upcoming next week with the direct action group of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement. And specifically, we're going to talk with them about engaging in some direct action with us around stop and frisk. And there is receptivity to that. We're going to tell them, y'all need to do this direct action with us targeting stop and frisk.
There's a school of thought that says that the fact that these demonstrators began at least as largely white, very young and affluent, was a good thing because, like the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964, when the white kids were sent in and got brutalized by police, the nation took notice.
Yeah, that's actually true. The seeing those cops spraying pepper spray into the faces of some young white women really, like, shocked people, because you could see the women were, like, standing there being corralled in by the NYPD and putting up no resistance. And it did shock and stun people, including it shocked and stunned the protesters, which when we began to discuss with them what they do all the time, they actually had a certain framework to look at it. Well, they came here and did this to us, and we weren't doing anything wrong. So maybe what I used to think was cops dealing with people who are doing wrong isn't what it comes down to. Now, we also have to take up misconceptions, because there's a view that, well, the white shirts, as they call them, the higher-ranking police are the problem, and the beat cops, well, they're our brothers. They're part of the 99%. And, you know, we just had to struggle with them over those wrong notions, because while any rotten fish stinks from the head, when you talk about the NYPD, it is rotten through and through, you know, and a lot of those beat cops were transferred from patrolling places in Harlem, places in Bed-Stuy, places in the South Bronx, like an occupying army, dealing out harassment, humiliation on a daily level to hundreds of people in New York, especially black and Latino youth, through stop and frisk. You know, so it isn't like they become friends and part of the people when they come down the Wall Street. So we had to struggle with them over that. But people could see that these cops dish out brutality to people who don't deserve it. And that opened them up to want to hear. And we're going to go back with some of the parents of police murder victims. We're going to do that next week. Juanita Young in particular, Aileen Person, both of whom have endorsed the call to stop, stop, and frisk, and are stalwarts in the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, are going to go down to Wall Street with us, you know, and address the assemblage there and tell them of how the cops murdered their children, and that those particular murdering cops have faced no punishment for the crimes that they've committed. So we see the Wall Street occupation movement as an opening and an opportunity to go among some people who are trying to deal with injustice and let them know the scope of the injustice that actually exists. So that's how we're approaching the Occupy Wall Street.
The Stop, Stop and Frisk civil disobedience campaign that Carl Dick speaks of kicks off on October 21st at a police precinct designated by the people as the worst in Harlem. David DeGraw, editor of the online publication Amped Status, is among the relatively small group that set the stage for the Wall Street occupation. DeGraw belongs to a working group that is determined that the protest not be co-opted by any political party or their operatives. The occupation remains purposely leaderless. We asked DeGraw how long that can continue.
I really don't have a good answer to that, really. You know, it is a decentralized movement. You know, right now it's tens of thousands of people taking it upon themselves to fight back against their own personal financial hardships and in defense of their family members who are struggling with debt, unemployment, foreclosures, poverty. So, you know, right now we're in the early moments of the movement, and it's just really people taking it upon themselves to fight back against their financial oppression.
But we do see that a group of you are tackling the question of how to draw up an economic platform or a list of economic demands.
Right. Well, I mean, that is, to say it's a group, it's really there's many, many different groups all trying to figure out what our demands will be. And really, at this point, Glenn, I mean, there's definitely certain themes, coming together as far as getting money out of politics, breaking up the banks, maybe something like as far as legislation. You have Glass-Steagall. Maybe as a first step to breaking up the banks, you have the Brown-Kaufman Amendment that failed during the financial reform process. Everyone really has their own opinion, and right now it's just, this giant melting pot of frustration, and everyone, is really just voicing their concerns. We're just trying to let this have like a natural progression to see where it takes us. Trying to control it right now, it is leaderless, it is decentralized, and anyone who comes in and tries to control this, it's like, being in a rowboat during a tsunami. I mean, you can't control it right now. You just have to let people take it upon themselves and see where this thing takes us.
And yet, from looking and hearing the language used to describe the big banks as basically evil incarnate, which they are, we then see suggestions of rather mild reformist language in terms of fixing the problem.
Well, what do you mean by mild reformist?
Well, return of Glass-Steagall would be mild and reformist.
Yeah, let me be clear about that, though. These are like first step, things that people have considered that are at least already out there that can be moved upon quickly. It's not the be-all, end-all by any means. I can't speak for the movement. Really, no one can speak for the movement at this point. It's such a diverse set of views. But the central theme is, breaking up the concentration of power. I would think, if anything, we say it's a decentralized movement. And essentially, there is a uniting, philosophy of decentralism, if I can call it that, where we break up the grip of power. Certainly throughout history, there's the iron law of oligarchy. You start out with something diffuse and democratic, and as time goes by, that iron claw of oligarchy tightens its grip on the people. And, what we're doing right now is we're trying to break up that tight grip. We have the highest inequality of wealth we've ever had in our country. We have the highest number of people living in poverty we've ever had. We have well over 200 million Americans living paycheck to paycheck right now. So, obviously the system's broken. It doesn't work for 99% of the U.S. population. And what we're doing right now is we're fighting back against that concentration of power. And, like I said, this is my personal opinion of how I perceive things. I can't speak for the movement as a whole, because it's just a whole broad range of issues and concerns.
Were you concerned that the movement was very, very white and very, very young?
Yes.
In the early days, certainly.
Yes. We were concerned, just really more in regard to how we were perceived in the media. The media tended to, be much more willing to speak to, white males and to focus on, the middle class, really white males. Basically, there's been a focus on that. And we've been in a lot of discussion to try and, feature the diversity. Because if you go down to Liberty Park, it's really not a whole bunch of, white kids sitting around there. It is very mixed. And especially these protest marches you go on, they really do represent a cross section, you know, of the 99% of the people. You know, there's certain people who've been in the trenches for years and can speak intelligently and concisely on these issues. And, you know, we need those people. And, you know, as far as the people on the ground, you know, there is a learning process. You know, everyone knows they've been screwed, but they don't necessarily know exactly how. I mean, everyone kind of gets that the banks robbed the country, but, you know, the details, if you want to talk about, you know, derivatives and you know, the CDOs and stuff, you know, people don't really understand that fully yet. And there's a whole education process that's happening now. I mean, on the ground at Liberty Park, it is truly a direct democracy. The General Assembly, you're one person, you have one vote, one voice, and it's a teach-ins, working groups, it's a learning process. It really is, you know, the beginning of a movement. You know, where it's going to go, no one really knows that.
Here's the double-edged question. What's it going to take to make you stay, and what's it going to take to make you leave the park?
Well, I can tell you this. Everyone that's here is not planning on going anywhere. I mean, there's extensive plans on, you know, to get us through the winter because, you know, the winters are bitterly cold in New York City, very windy. But, you know, there's many plans. You know, nobody plans on going anywhere until there is some significant change. And, you know, we're still trying to figure out what exactly that change is going to look like. So, I mean, we're in it for the long haul. There's no question about that.
Could that be something as mild as Obama promising to look into the possibilities of passing or reinstituting Glass-Steagall?
No. I would definitely not. Glenn, the people down here are so inspiring, so committed and dedicated. You know, they're not going to be, you know, satisfied by some exploratory committee. Or even, you know, passing Glass-Steagall, in my opinion, would be a significant step forward. But I don't even think people would go home at that point. You know, that's a first step, but that's certainly far from where we want to be.
David DeGraw, one of the early organizers of the Wall Street occupation. A large contingent of Haitian Americans marched across the Brooklyn Bridge to join in solidarity with the Liberty Park protesters. Haitian community and labor activist Ray LaForest explains.
It's a great opportunity. We think that Haiti is an amazing example of that beast, imperialist beast that is destroying this country, destroying people of color, destroying working people. Somebody said yesterday, this is not a quest of capitalism, the quest is capitalism. And I like that. This is a capitalism that maybe hasn't been said enough in some of those demonstrations in Wall Street, that is not just being bailed out while we got sold out, but that they're willing to use any means necessary to achieve what they want, including wretched conditions, including what they've imposing on the Haitian people, and including incredible violence, physical violence of weaponry, and the violence of malnutrition, of denial of rights, denial of education, health care, which the Haitian people is experiencing every day. So for us, we can clearly see that we're fighting a common enemy. We think those kids are pretty brave, and we think that they have captured the imagination of people. Clearly, there have been other struggles before, but we have to seize this one. We have to find a way to make the connection as efficiently and as best and as humanly as possible and use this spotlight and this attention that people are paying for us to magnify this movement and make sure that something is not something that's going to die because it gets cold. So clearly, when you look back on movements, sometimes you didn't know that something could have been the beginning. I'm sure what happened in the Arab world, nobody saw it as the beginnings of something that would portend such amazing changes. Our very future, our very lives, everyday life of the Asian masses are being denied by the same greedy, what I call criminal, really. They're not just greedy, they're criminal. They're doing actions that result in the destruction of whole societies, whole cultures, and the destruction of human lives, and incredible personal suffering to many human beings. It is time we grab the bull by the horn, if not some other place, and then we bring that bull down. Now, we have no illusion that this is necessarily the moment, but we, part of what it has to be, we have to make it the moment. We have to grab this opportunity and make the most out of it. not only immediately in the streets, but if we're not able to get this be something that they cannot stop, to make it so that there are lasting effects from this in terms of structural changes within progressive movement, within the movement of people of color, particularly African Americans fighting in this country, in this belly of the beast for so long and being denied a reality, a place in the sun for so long, and so much disrespect, so much humiliation, and so much suffering. And as they say in Spanish, basta ya, enough already. We've had it and we don't take it anymore.
Were you surprised at the speed with which this movement against Wall Street became so exciting to so many people?
Well, in a way I was not, but in a way I was, because sometimes the objective conditions are there for people to no longer to say enough, they won't will take this anymore. And we know they don't because they're disunited, because they were infiltrated by the police and other negative forces, FBI and what else. We know we're being divided by outside forces. And as you can, you tell yourself, except for media such as yours, the mainstream press ignored it completely at first. So in a way, I was both surprised and not surprised.
Was there any problem in reaching any kind of consensus within Haitian political circles to join in solidarity with the Wall Street protests?
Not really. The problems that we have been rather chronic recently. The community has been divided because of lack of leadership within the progressive community, because of huge amount of money being thrown at people to disinformation. And also, we had faced the earthquake was a major event that brought people to their knees in terms of not being able to meet their, you know, their even basic needs, which was the reality for many people before, but situation where people don't even remember almost when they had the last meal. It gives the other side an opportunity to try to steal the show, and in Haiti they have succeeded to some extent. What we look also looking at in Haiti now with Sweet Mickey is a return of devaluism, clearly so. At least of gentilism in the form of baby dog. So it's a complete right wing coup. The Haitian people have shown the ability to learn from its own mistakes and understand clearly, and leadership is clearly needed from progressive forces. Native Haitians who believe truly in change and are willing to put everything in the line and use their brains also to come up with the best solutions. Also, economic factors, we call for the demonstration very short notice, and if you're a factory worker, I guess it's really difficult to just afford in these days and as tough as things are, to lose a day's pay or to risk losing your job if you call sick and they say they see you on the demonstration. So we know it's a problem, but we're doing our best. It's an opportunity for us to open the dialogue again rather than jump on that moment, and if it's missed, decide that it can happen again. But in terms of the community's understanding of the extension of the struggle, the application of those demands to themselves, for a long time, the Haitian community, both here and Haiti, have understood those factors quite well.
Haitian community activist Ray LaForest in New York, Black Agenda Report columnist Jemima Pierre recently wrote an article lamenting the failure of African Americans to stand up for Haiti in recent years.
I've been thinking about everything that has been going on in Haiti since Obama became president. So from the fourth selection, we would say, of Michel Martelly, Sweet Mickey, where Hillary Clinton went in and pressured the Elections Council in Haiti to actually reinstitute Martelly's name after he didn't make the second round, to forcing the elections, even though the situation was not set for elections in Haiti. And then also to allowing Papadoc to come back, but then at the same time lobbying the South African government, trying to force them to keep Harris Speed out. And so you have this ongoing one thing after another in Haiti. And so now you have Clinton, who completely controls Haiti. He's the UN envoy. He's the co-chair of the Reconstruction Committee. And now his chief of staff is tapped to be the prime minister. And we all know that that's just been the push of the State Department to control Haiti like that. Plus the 1,000-strong minister, the UN military occupation force, that's still in Haiti. So I see all of that, and I'm wondering where the outrage is. I'm like, so where are our Black progressives, Black academics, everyone who touts Haiti's history, you know, as the first Black republic, and everyone who knows that? That it is a sad thing for me. It's a sad day, and I feel like it's a shift from African-American response to Haiti in the past. And it's a scary shift, I think, for Pan-Africanism, for Black people worldwide.
Yes, we had a period when Black people were very vocal about the treatment of Haitian refugees and made their feelings known about that. And yet now, with a black president in charge, the entire country is treated as if it is no longer a nation, and we hear nothing.
It's absolutely mind-boggling, you know, and I think there are a couple of things going on. I think there's less of a focus, you know, on international politics within the black community. I mean, I think look at what's happening in Africa, right? Look at Libya, look at what's happening in Somalia. And so back in the days, we used to, you know, all of those struggles were linked, right? We used to think about what was happening in the U.S., lynchings and so on and so forth, as linked to what was happening in Africa and the Caribbean, right? Colonialism and imperialism and so on and so forth. But even within the U.S., where you had, for example, African-Americans protesting against the CDC labeling Haitians as, you know, one of the four H's, as for AIDS carriers, right, asking for refugee asylum, as you mentioned earlier, my point was to say that it hasn't always been the case that African-American, you know, the political class would turn a blind eye to really a worse kind of imperialism than we've ever seen, especially when it comes to the United States relationship with Haiti.
You speak of W.E.B. Du Bois's attention to Haiti and the great James Weldon Johnson and his work on behalf of the Haitians. This legacy seems, however, to be forgotten.
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the great things about Du Bois and the crisis is the black internationalism in it, right? So back then, we used to be able to educate each other about what was going on in the world. And so, and the NAACP was very much part of that. So the crisis would educate black Americans about what was happening all over the world when it kind of came to black people. The NAACP was very much interested in that. So they sent James Weldon Johnson to Haiti on a fact-finding mission. And he ended up staying a long time. And he actually writes about this in his biography about his stay in Haiti. And it was because he went there and he interviewed the white Southern drunken soldiers that were there lynching Haitians and killing them and being very frank about what they thought of the Negroes. And then he was able to come back and influence then-candidate Harding's campaign by basically Harding used the Haiti occupation as a campaign issue in his election. But he was also able to write very explicit reports for The Nation and a few other journals about really what was going on in Haiti. And that really brought the U.S. attention, the black community as well as the larger communities, brought their attention to what was going on in Haiti at the time, which was massive murder and exploitation under a U.S. military occupation from 1915 to 1935.
Do black Americans, are they in danger of losing that kind of free pass that we once had in the world, where the world gave us a dispensation that we were not the ugly Americans, we were different?
Definitely, and that was the point, and that's the sadness that I feel. I think that African Americans have always had this moral authority, in a sense, because they've been at the forefront of the struggle for black emancipation from the very beginning, right? As well as Haiti, I suppose. And they've always been the ones to critique the U.S. government, the state actions, right? State sanctioned violence, imperialism abroad, they were the ones to critique that and to critique that soundly. And now we don't get that critique. We don't get an anti-war critique as our nation wages war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia. So now we don't get any of that critique. And so silence is consent. If you're being silent and you're not making the same critiques as you were when George W. Bush was bombing, then something is wrong. And that means that you condone Obama's actions. And for that, you don't deserve that moral authority that you've always had and the sympathy that the world has always given because of your position as black Americans in this country.
Jemima Pierre of Black Agenda Report. Postal Service workers are desperately trying to head off layoffs that could claim 100,000 jobs and shut down many facilities. Michael Plaskin, Executive Vice President of the Letter Carriers Union in Pittsburgh, says the crisis has been manufactured by Congress, which forced the Postal Service to pay $5 billion a year to pension funds up front. Plaskin says the Internet has taken business from the Postal Service, but there's no real crisis.
Is the solution to cut service? Is the solution to reduce a day's delivery, which would entail tens of thousands and maybe 100,000 layoffs, directly or indirectly, to the whole postal stream? It accounts for a huge proportion of the economy, the Postal Service. You know, we're not just talking craft employees. We're not just talking about postal employees. You know, we're talking about the mailing industry and how the effects of elimination of one-day service, how that would affect the economy. And at this particular time, that's the last thing we need, is to have massive layoffs. And what's bothersome is it could be fixed. It could be very easily fixed through Congress and through legislation. I mean, our argument was that Congress created this mess, Congress can fix it. We're advocating for H.R. 1351. Stephen Lynch's bill has 220 supporters now, bipartisan support. And we're not even asking to say, okay, no other company or no other business has to make this pre-funding for future retiree health care benefits. We'll make the payment. Just let's take the excess of money that's in our retirement system and apply it to that. And that would be a solution. So the Postmaster General isn't advocating that as a solution. What he's advocating is reduction of service. He wants to reduce more than 50% of the mail processing facilities in the country. That in and of itself, it would cause the Postal Service to have service to be delayed. I mean, right now we have on-time service standards that are at the all-time highest. The customer service satisfaction ratings are at the all-time highest. You know, the Postal Service is the most trusted government agency 6 years running. We have never performed better with less than we've ever had in our history. So why, if you're supposed to be acting more like a business, do you want to fundamentally undercut what you do to take away 50% or more of our mail processing facilities? Would then Erie would be moved to Pittsburgh. Youngstown would be moved to Pittsburgh. Greensburg would be moved to Pittsburgh. Wheeling. All these processing plants around the area, we're all going to go to one mail processing center now here in Pittsburgh. And I'm just talking about here locally in our area. Now, if you have a letter to be mailed in Erie, they're going to have to take that letter. It's going to have to come all the way to Pittsburgh and then go back to Erie for it to be processed. It's just incredibly ridiculous. And what's going to happen, as the post office has said it is, we're going to have to reduce our standards for on-time delivery. It's an unbelievable. If you're in the business, you know, you don't basically fundamentally cut the things that you do that you've been successful at doing and very good at doing, and now you want to, you know, now you're going to undermine it. So now the service is going to deteriorate. And now the faith in the trust the public has in the Postal Service is going to deteriorate. So no longer will we be the most trusted government agency. No longer will our scores be as good as they are on time delivery service standards. They're going to be reduced. And then that, you know, that opens the door. You know, if we can make the service not as good as it was before, maybe the private industry can do a little bit better. If we can take away day delivery service and, you know, let the private sector come in and do what we do, then maybe we can do another day and then another day. And pretty soon you're going to scrap altogether what we do. But the problem is the private sector isn't going to do what we do with universal pricing and universal standards. They will be happy to make a profit in doing what we do in an affluent neighborhood. But they're not going to give a rat's ass about who gets, you know, the person whose mailbox sits at the end of a dirt road. Those people aren't going to get the kind of service, universal service, that everybody in this country deserves. You know, people who live in neighborhoods that are in economic distress, you know, that's not going to be profitable for them. So they're not going to want that. They will pick and choose and take what's out there in the free market that would be profitable. And that's not what the Postal Service is about. It's about providing mail delivery to everybody, regardless of who you are.
And in fact, the U.S. government allowed UPS and FedEx and those that came after to cherry pick the delivery systems.
And the ironic part is, they use us. I go out to do grievances at post offices, and I see the brown truck backing into the Postal Service to drop off packages for us to do the last mile delivery, because it makes good economic sense. Because we're there every day. Does it make good economic sense for the brown truck to go from 207 Union Street and then go 10 blocks away to 587 Lincoln Avenue? Guess what? We're there delivering every house every day, every business every day. They utilize us to make a profit, and they don't even do the work. So, and we can't deny them that, because we can't deny anybody. And that's again, what we do. Universal pricing for everybody, regardless. Universal standards, universal delivery. I just think that what happened was with Congress, they put this mandate on us to put us in a position where we're in a financial, well, it looks like we're in a financial crisis, and really the reality is we're not. There is a simple fix legislatively, but what bothers me is that, you know, the leadership of the Postal Service doesn't look at that. They're looking at the answers to cut service, to close post offices. They want to close 3,000, 4,000 post offices. And then that's just going to make it harder for people who use those post offices to rely upon the postal service. You know, you eliminate day delivery, the next thing is, well, maybe we have to eliminate another day delivery, then another, and then pretty soon there is no more post office. The idea of cutting 50% of the mail processing plants is just unbelievable to me, because they're already saying, if we do that, we're going to lower our standards now. So it to me, it seems it's a manufacturer crisis, and the solution is to put the Postal Service in a position where it can't succeed. It's doomed for failure. And then that just opens the door for private into free market. And then for the rest of the country, too bad. If you're not going to be the ones who are going to be in a position or a neighborhood that would be profitable to the private sector, well, then you're going to pay an arm and a leg to get service.
The legislation that you hope would alleviate this situation, H.R. 1351, you say has 211 co-sponsors, but does it have the support of the administration, the White House?
Unfortunately, about 2 weeks ago, the White House came out in favor of eliminating a day's service. Now, this is the thing that I can only speculate on. And a lot of what I'm telling you is it's a lot of personal opinion of why things are happening. I could look back in history and say, okay, in 2003, the Bush administration put a guy named James Miller into the head of the Postal Board of Governors. And this is a guy who wrote his doctorate thesis on how to privatize the Postal Service. And then, you know, the legislation that was being pushed from then up until, you know, the passage of the legislation in 2006 that put us in the position we're in. I mean, that's there, but, you know, I can just speculate on, you know, how we got to there. And I can only speculate on why the administration is doing, you know, what they're doing by advocating the elimination of a day of service. The part I don't understand is why it's part of the budget deficit package, because we're budget neutral. We have nothing to do with the deficit. If they could somehow make it look like by eliminating a day's delivery and they could save some $10, $20 billion by doing that over a certain amount of time, and that's going to make the books for the overall budget deficit look that way, then okay, I could see why they're doing it. But from my understanding is we have nothing to do with that. I mean, we are a complete separate entity of the federal government. We don't rely on any taxes. We're self-sufficient. And I don't understand how, you know, it's hypocritical that the administration would say, you know, we need jobs. It's all about jobs right now. We have to create jobs, and then you're going to advocate a policy that's going to eliminate 100,000 jobs? That's baffling to me, and I really can't say why they want to do that.
So the administration has lumped the Postal Service into the budget debate where it doesn't belong, just as it has done Social Security.
Yes, that's exactly right, yes.
You know, many people don't even understand that the Postal Service does not cost the taxpayers money.
That's right. Like I said, we're completely self-sufficient. Don't rely on any taxpayer money at all. It sure seems to me that this is, you know, it's a manufacturer crisis. And I referred to that article as in Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, Disaster Capitalism. I mean, it was almost like they took a page right out of that book, and that's exactly what they're doing. I think it bothers a lot of the free market ideologues that there is a potential to make money in what we do, and they can't get their hands on it, and it bothers them.
And finally, back to Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., with some words from hip-hop artist Head Rock.
Greed is the first of its kind, and a state of mind, and their take on the divine allowed them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord that they do whatever's necessary for their position. That is the decision when they on a mission. That is the decision when they on a mission. Now what we talk about? Imperialism. That is the decision when they on a mission. Now what we talk about? Every second Monday in October, we hold a celebration for a Western soldier who brought over a culture manifestly destined to rule and take over. Hey, it's funny how in the name of Jehovah, he's supposed to be the landowner more so than the first holder. Ask the natives in Plymouth about the caravan next to the soldier. From what they told you in high school about righteous conquest, brave explorers, little revealed by the millions killed with a government queer trying to seal up the whole. Hey, the superpowers locked in a chess match. Like who can't they get that? See who is dispatched, persist that, who the tax. Promote all the tax, we give tax plus import crack. Now tell me what you think about that. Do it sound familiar to me too, cousin, I feel ya. And all because I picked up a book, then look, it was shipped by the these crooks, took down. Chris Columbus, a man of his time, saw the arrow black leaders, the further it's time that they stay to mind, then take on the divine, allow them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord, that they do whatever's necessary for their position. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Now what we talking about? Imperialism!
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Kyle Pollard.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.